Okay, thank you. Okay, good morning. So, okay, yes, this is the title. Well, this is, I'm from Bariloche, Argentina, in the south. Actually, this is a nice photo that taken by Kai Bisi near Bariloche.
You have to invite us.
yeah, that's why I'm showing this. you're welcome. It's a very nice place. Well, this is more or less the plan of my talk. I'm going to talk about domain wall dynamics, which is exactly creep dynamics, which is kind of thermally activated dynamics, which is collective of domain walls, like the one that is here below in this picture. This is an experimental picture using magneto optics. This is a magnetic domain wall with the magnetization pointing up and down in the other side. So I know that some of you are really experts on this, and some others maybe don't know the problem of creep, so I'll try to do some introduction, mainly showing experimental data and very basic theoretical predictions. So what I'll try to convince you in the first part is that actually these systems are very, very nice because they really display like universal dynamics. I mean, we can see clearly universal activated dynamics. And so this I will spend some slides showing to you that. And in fact, I consider this is one of the systems where we can really see the universal dynamics that we expect from disordered elastic system. And this system in particular is interesting because below the dependent threshold, we can see this universality. Okay, and then in the second part of my talk, let's say, I'll show you that there are also new phenomena that appeared in some recent, very recent experiments, that there's no rigorous theory. So just try to motivate the theory. And then I will show you some work in progress we're doing with Alberto and Ezequiel Ferrero about new theoretical prediction for the creep motion that has not been observed yet in experiment. It could be very nice. And this is maybe the plan. So just to make a connection, we say this is the blackboard of the first day of the meeting, I guess. I can make a connection of what I'm going to talk about is disordered elastic systems. So it's directly connected with these kind of models. I'm going to talk about thermal effects, which mainly we were, or most of the talks, particularly about avalanches, they didn't talk about thermal effects. So I'll discuss that. We will see which are the effects. In fact, Mark Robbins already posed this question and also posed the question of which are the effect of inertia. I'll discuss the universal activated dynamics, which I'm telling you about. Then I also will talk a lot about this question, which is here. Where is it? How good the elastic line? So in fact, this is the main model I will use, and then we'll try to convince you how much you can predict with this kind of very minimalistic models. And also, I would like just to say that, okay, I will talk, some moment I'll talk about avalanches, but in general, I will talk about irreversibly collective jumps that can occur, not only at the pinning, but also near the statics, and also in the creep motion dominance. So first, let me just tell you about this work that was very recently published. This is mainly experimental work done by Sean Gorchon in Orsay. I was just involved in the interpretation of these results. And what they study is basically this problem. They have a thin film ferromagnetic material. They prepare some domain wall, and then they drive it with some applied field. So this is basically the main physical problem. So they can take a photograph of these domain walls by magneto optics. These films have an anisotropic, perpendicular anisotropy. So this is really like the IC model here. Magnetization is pointing up, here it's down. In the middle we have the domain wall, which is typically rough due to this competition between elasticity and disorder. And the question we will ask is what happens when we apply, for instance, a magnetic field in this direction. So this will favor the growth of this domain. And this will push the domain wall in this direction, right? So, well, these are some details of the experiments. I'm not going to enter into much detail because I'm not also not an experimentalist, but this is our well-controlled system where many universal phenomena was found. So basically, what I'm going to...
This is monoatomic? I mean, five
atoms? Yes, the very thing, well, this is a cobaltum platinum cobalto film. Yeah, it's very thin. This is, I don't know how they prepare it, but well, they have been studying it for a long time. And
the disorder is just
yeah.
But it's not a spin gas.
No.
There's always a surface, right?
The disorder is weak, right? Yeah.
It's the surface.
I
see. That's the only source of
the disorder.
The roughness of the surface, but this is it.
Yeah. What is important is that I will consider weak disorder because we can consider other cases where the disorder is strong and the elastic approximation is not well met. But yeah, this is.
So why is that a pinning disorder?
The condensation energy for the order parameter is heterogeneous, so that's why there are places where the domain wall would like to be, and this is producing the pinning. You know? It's like a pinning for the for vortices is the same. You know? Where you depress the order parameter, then you expect vortices to go there. No? This is similar, no? Where you have already depressed the condensation energy, then it's better to put the domain wall there so you can gain this condensation energy. This is the origin. Okay, it's easy to see in, for instance, 5-4 model you can describe. Or you can also describe it as a fluctuation of TC or something like this.
You have any idea of the way it is deposited? Because it's perfectly
perfectly
monocrystal layer.
We can check later in the paper. Yeah, I don't know much
of it. It's all ferromagnetic, but if I were to think of an effective PLE due to the neighbors, the effective coupling is
no, I think it's a random field,
right?
Coming on the surface.
It's not random field, it's a random one disorder. Yeah. In a 5-4 model, it's easy, we can discuss later to get pinning from. But you can think it just as, in a 5-4 model, you have the epsilon zero, the small barrier, and then if you put fluctuations on that, this will induce a random bond disorder. And okay, what I'm saying is I will consider only weak random bond disorder.
And here, I'm sorry, I missed that. The spins are in plane, or?
No, these are out of plane because this system has a. Yeah.
So you definitely have
a. Yeah. They can make it there. So the basic question I'm going to ask is which is the velocity of this front as a function of the applied magnetic field and the temperature? Okay. So the velocity is just the center of mass velocity of the domain wall. And this can be observed by Van Eyck optics, right? This is a picture where they can. So what you can see here is that when you drive the domain wall is rough. This is due to pinning. For instance, here there's a strong pinning. The domain wall would like to be flat, but pinning try to compete with this order by the interface wanders. So this is the basic. So we will ask what is the velocity. Okay, from one side, this is important, of course, for applications. We want to be able to control the motion of domain walls. But what I'll be interested more is in the universality that can appear due to this competition between elasticity and disorder, and in particular in this collective transport problem. And this is why this is important, because what we can learn from this system maybe can be applied to other systems which share an effective similar physics, like contact lines, or we saw also in Laurent talk that at some moment under some approximation, under some experimental condition, we could describe the crack propagation as in Elasticline, in random media. Also, Alberto talked about earthquake models that are based on this, also in the dynamics of interfaces. We have also, for instance, ferroelectric domain walls, which are the analogous of ferromagnetic domain walls, but in ferroelectrics. These are some examples. So we will start just by making the minimalistic model of the domain wall, which is simply to say, okay, we will forget about all the spin degrees of freedom, let's say, all the, and we will just focus on the domain wall. And the domain wall, if we don't have a, if the disorder is weak, the domain walls can be described by some function. If we don't have overhangs or bubbles, we can describe it just by a field, which is a function of fix. And that, and then if we want to describe the dynamics, we can work, we have the time. So we will propose some equation, the simplest equation of motion for an elastic interface that takes into account all the main ingredients is probably the Quencher-Wall-Wilkinson equation, which is a very simple equation saying just that the motion is the motion of the interface is overdamped, which is usually the case. Of course, we could also discuss which is the, if there is some inertia in inertial terms important or not. In this case, we don't find that, that it's important. So this is just a friction force, which then we have the elasticity, which in the limit of small deformations can be described just by this Laplacian, tries to smooth the interface. Yes, to then we will have some pinning force, which will depend on the position of domain wall and on x. Typically, we will take it, in the simplest case, we will consider an uncorrelated disorder, which is generated, for instance, by impurities. And impurities will try to distort the line, a flat line. They will try to destroy it, to distort it. And finally, we can add some driving force, which for the magnetic domain wall is proportional to the applied magnetic field. And to mimic the effect of temperature, we can add a Langevin noise, which has, incorporates the effect of temperature. So this is, we will consider just this model, which is probably the minimal model for studying elastic line in random media, or domain wall in random media. And the reason is because this is far more simpler than a micromagnetic model. And the other reason is that we expect, I mean, we can, this model, at least we can make more predictions and we can try to seek for universal behavior.
So does the domain matter in any particular,
it's very relevant in this. What I'm going to discuss is the motion below the dependent threshold. So at zero temp, I'll discuss that. But yes, this is the. So this is the main question I will pose is, do magnetic domain walls, a complicated system, behave as simple elastic string in disordered media? So at first sight, qualitatively, one can say that yes. I mean, this is here on this side, I have some, the predictions of the theory from many years of work. This is the velocity of a domain wall as a function of the applied force. Okay, at zero temperature, the velocity is zero until we reach some dependent transition at some value of F that I will call it FC. Above this dependent transition, we have a velocity that typically will increase as a power law very near the critical point as a power law with some exponent, critical exponent beta. This is just analogous to a phase transition, but this is a dynamic phase transition. So this is at zero temperature. And then when we increase the force, we find this flux flow regime with the velocities mainly proportional to the force. Okay, so below the dependent threshold, we don't have motion because we are blocked by metastable state because we have barriers. And the only way to produce a final velocity is to add some temperature. If we add some temperature, then we have by Arrhenius activation, we can overcome these barriers. And then we produce a final velocity. there is a regime at small temperatures, exactly at the critical point, that is called the thermal rounding regime, where we expect, also by analogy with standard phase transitions, to have a velocity controlled by the temperature, and then there is a new critical exponent psi. And well below the dependent threshold, which is here, we expect to find the creep regime. Okay, the main prediction for the creep regime is that for an elastic line in a disordered media, the response will be highly nonlinear. In fact, when F goes to zero, you see that this diverges. So this means that the barriers that we have to overcome in order to move diverge. And now we can compare with the experiment. These are recent experimental, relatively recent experimental data showing the three regimes that I already described. So we have the creep regime here. This is okay for two samples, have the creep regime, the dependent region, and the flux flow regime. So qualitatively, it looks that, I mean, this picture could work. And of course, then the question is, if this is, I mean, this connection works quantitatively, right? And so for instance, is this exponent found here, or these two other exponents, can we find them in this experiment? And also it is we have the question of which is the universality class. I mean, if we find exponents, are they the same that the simply Quencher or Wilkinson I just shown you? So maybe the most prominent regime to study that is the creep regime, as I already, well, I'll discuss in details later how is that we can get this result. But one of the main predictions is this creep law. This is called the creep law. And let's see how does it work for the experiment. So the creep law was derived by Yoffe and Binokur and Natterman a long time ago, using very nice scaling arguments. The idea is basically to use a nucleation picture. Let's say we have the blocked elastic line. And then in order to move, we have to overcome some barrier by a Reynolds activation. Okay, and what they did, and I'm not going to enter into much details now, they calculated which is the optimal critical nucleus that we have to overcome in order to move to the next metastable state. And what they found is that the velocity, or if you want, the velocity, which is mainly controlled by the time we have to spend to overcome this barrier, well, is determined by an Arrhenius law like this. But where the barriers, as I already showed before, is described by this function. So yes, as you can see, this barrier diverges with when f goes to zero, and there is a very precise value for this exponent mu. So they predicted for the first time this sublinear universal response. And what is very nice about the derivation is that they got an expression for mu which depends only on the roughness exponent of these interfaces. So this is the roughness exponent of this interface that can be obtained from other methods, and then we can predict the value of mu precisely. Okay, this roughness will depend on a lot of details, like the dimension or the nature of correlations of the disorder. But we can calculate it. In particular, in this case, we can calculate it just by doing equilibrium analysis of the interface. So it's the same that we find for instance, for the ground state of the elastic line in a random media. And they also predicted that the size of this thermal nucleus, this critical nucleus, also diverges as a power law of the force with some also very precise value for this exponent, which is given here, which can also be related directly to the geometry at equilibrium. So, and one can say that this diversion that they find here is consistent with the glassy nature of the elastic line in equilibrium, right? At equilibrium, at zero force, we expect the line to be blocked in metacellular configurations that are separated by divergent barriers.
And the roughness exponent can depend on the kind of model that I'm thinking about for the interface in the equilibrium.
Yeah, yeah, it depends on the dimension. And for instance, for the case of dimension one, an uncorrelated disorder, right? General uncorrelated disorder, it has a very precise value, that is 2/3. Well, that can be computed by several methods.
So t equals 1 would be a line in...
Yeah. This is a 1 plus 1 problem, yeah. This is the dimension of the manifold, the elastic line, and it's moving in a two-dimensional media. So it has only one direction of displacement. So for this case, for instance, which should correspond to the one-dimensional domain wall, we get these very precise values. So these are quantitative precise predictions for the problem. So now we can compare with experiments and see whether this simple model can account for them. So maybe the most beautiful for me experiment that has been done showing this physics is this one, which was published in 2009. The idea is just to take, again, a ferromagnetic film, a ferromagnetic wire of some width, W. So what they did is basically they studied the velocity of this domain wall when we apply a magnetic field like this. Okay, and they started to cut the sample more and more for such that at a given field we reach a size of the wire that is comparable to the size of the thermal nucleus. That's very nice, because if this picture of the creep motion is okay, then we should expect a crossover, right? Because the dependence of the barriers with the magnetic field should have a crossover. Okay, the barriers should saturate when the width of the domain wall is of the order of the size of the thermal nucleus. And this is exactly what they show here. So let me explain the pictures here, the plots. So this is the logarithm of the velocity as a function of h to the minus 1/4. So this should be a straight line, okay, like this one, if the creep law is a well description. And this is what we see here. And so let's say the creep law works very well, except when the condition, when the size of the thermal nucleus becomes of the order of the wide width. And then we see a crossover to a different behavior that can be interpreted as a dimensional crossover to particle-like behavior, right? So this is very nice, because it's showing both that the creep law is valid, the velocity versus force characteristic in the creep regime is valid, but it's also showing that the mechanism that is producing this velocity is dominated by typical jumps of a certain size. So it's a really nice verification of the nucleation picture for a creep motion.
So the measure theta directly?
Theta?
The exponent theta.
Yeah. Here you can see, I didn't explain the picture, but here you can see the logarithm of the velocity, the same plot, but now multiplied by this factor. So when the size of the thermal nucleus is smaller than the width of the wire, then we expect something which is independent of the width of the wire. And then at some moment, okay, when the wire is equal to this quantity, sorry, to L, I think they call it L call to the size of the thermal nucleus, then we have the crossover. So yeah, that's what we were.
Yeah,
But if you this quasi well, you have some distribution of lines, right? So you volume or some other things.
Yeah. That's right. They don't see. I already. Yeah. I asked them how to add it. Yeah, that's Pierre. What Pierre is saying is that in the 1D problem, the velocity becomes very sensible to extreme events. I mean, extreme barriers. But okay, they didn't run the measure the velocity for, or maybe yeah. This is not a, it's an open question, but. But yeah, so this is.
They independently measure the roughness in this prediction.
No. In this, in this paper, no. But the grip exponent was actually measured before in this paper, which is Pierre is also in this this paper, and there they also try to measure the roughness exponent, and it's very close to the one expected at the equilibrium roughness exponent. But okay, within some error bar, we can discuss.
Single particle
value from U. No, they just the barrier saturates, so this is so it's just you don't have just linear response again with an exponential factor, right? So it's just if you saturate the barriers, then you just get some linear response with them, some exponential. Yes.
So is it easy to get mu equal to 1/4 even for correlated noise? In other words, you sort of said that this was derived for uncorrelated noise.
Yeah.
Right? Is that really true? Does the fact that I see 1/4 tell me that the noise in this experiment is uncorrelated, or is it sort of easy to get that even if the noise is correlated?
Which noise do you mean, the quench noise or the thermal?
The quench noise.
Okay, the quench noise. Well, yeah, this depends on the, I mean, if you have short-range correlated disorder, you get this value. I mean, in order to modify this value, you have to put long-range correlated disorder, which, there's no, yeah, that's a good point, but in this...
Right, and so you can sort of say definitively that in this experiment the noise is either uncorrelated or only short range correlated. That's sort of what you learned.
It's
extremely difficult to find experimental system with long range correlated.
For first principles, No, that's right.
There are no real effects.
For such a complicated system, it's the elastic line depending. How does this exponent change when you do things in the disorder?
If you have a random column disorder, which exists, or a random field, then the exponential equilibrium is 1, it's not 2.
This is very.
This is the two physical examples, which are the random bond or random.
Correct. So what we are looking at now is random bond.
So we can
all uncorrelated.
This is very sensible to this kind of. I mean, yes, but to say that the roughness exponent that determines this exponent is very different from random bond to random field for short range correlated disorder.
I asked about the quench noise.
You can put some correlated thermal noise, but
what is big delta?
Sorry?
What is big delta?
Sorry. No, I was just, I put this question, just to say that the pinning force I'm considering here, I mean, it is considered to get this this result, is totally uncorrelated disorder, both in the direction, the direction, this is a C direction, so we have the interface. Sorry, I was using X, right? What? So this is x, and this is u, okay, u of x. So the disorder I'm considering here is the most simple one, is one that is uncorrelated in this direction and also in this direction, okay? So this is the universality class I'm considering here, and the one that gives place to these exponents in the equal one, which is also interesting because this is also telling us that the system is effectively 1D and is described by the Quencher-Wilkinson universality class. Another issue I didn't discuss, but these exponents also depend on the elastic interactions. As Laurent explained, for cracks, the interaction is long range, and the exponent, the roughness exponent of the interface is much different than the roughness for the short range elasticity. Okay, so this is also sensible to that part of the equation. So we have short range and correlated disorder, short range elasticity, and normal thermal noise, and this is what.
But the relation between mu and the roughness exponent is all valid for any kind of disorder.
Yeah.
This is universal.
This is universal.
Okay. So the argument by Lauf and Dinoguro is also for a not.
No. If it's correlated with x direction, it's not true.
If it's.
Because then the elasticity is changed.
Well, the, ah, you mean the.
It's correlated in the direction x, internal direction.
In the. This formula. I mean that this formula is valid when the. Sorry?
The formula for new.
For new. Okay, yeah. Okay, no.
Oh, because new is the length of this thing.
Yeah, sorry. This relation, yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
That's
This related to some symmetry, the statistical tilt symmetry. But okay, this controls the velocity, so this is critical exponent control the velocity, and this controls the size of the thermal nucleus. So, what I just try to convince you is that, the velocity force characteristic in these systems are qualitatively consistent with all the predictions of the 1D elastic string model, but in particular, the creep motion, you can describe it quantitatively, right? You can get the good exponents. And so this is telling us, or this is make us believe that this is really a good model to describe the systems, and this is because of the universality that is present in the thermally activated motion. So now the question is, what about the temperature depends? Because I didn't say anything about the temperature. Everything was done at ambient temperature. But here we have also the temperature. There are prefactors that could depend on temperature. And also here, we have prefactors that could depend on temperature. And in particular, many parameters that we have here, for instance, could depend in principle in temperature. So this is an open question. And another question is that so far we have only analyzed quantitatively this regime, but we didn't say anything about this regime below the dependent threshold and this dependent or thermally rounded dependent transition. So for this, we had to wait some years to get some data of the same data, but as a function of temperature. So this is the same system, the velocity force of the same system, but now as a function of field and as a function of temperature. And so we can now start to check all the scaling relations we expect for each regime. This is for different temperatures. You can see as you lower the temperature, the velocity decreases very sharply due to the barriers. And then at some critical field, we depend and we have some final velocity. So let me just show you.
This looks very different than your phase diagram, at least in the unpinned regime.
Well,
there's no curvature.
Yeah. Well, not here. They have some limitations. Let's say in the that they cannot reach very high fields. They cannot enter well in the high field regime. But then anyway, I'll show you that, okay, but below threshold, we can also get consistent.
So like an epsilon of 50%, so it's a huge, it's a huge system.
You mean that's large velocities?
Yeah, yeah, I mean,
it's all the system.
Well, yeah, no, there are many issues also about the, also the mobility, no, because this defines a mobility. Okay, this mobility could also depend on temperature. This is complicated. We'll try to simplify it as much as possible. But okay, for the creep regime, we can do the same kind of analysis and try to verify the creep law. So this is again the velocity of, as a function of the field. If you plot it this way, as a function of h to the minus 1/4, you can see clear straight lines saying that okay, the creep law works. This is for two different temperatures. Okay. But what we found is that in the regime of temperature we are, we cannot consider these two quantities. So you can see here that the dependence of field is described by this power law. And the dependence of temperature, I mean, should be described by this T. But what we find is that we have to include also the dependencies of temperature of these two parameters, these two microscopic non-universal parameters. Then we can fit these parameters and try to see if there is a consistent with the other. Okay, this is what we find. So this is more or less what we expect as we increase the temperature because we have this 1 over T. But it's not exactly 1 over T dependence, but it carries also an intrinsic temperature dependence through these two parameters here. Okay? I'll show you now the extra power, but there are corrections you have to take into account in order to disentangle. Yeah, I'll show you the.
Can you say where HC would be? The zero temperature of the pinning field, HC?
The pinning pressure.
Yeah.
The pinning pressure, where would it sit here?
Next one.
How many hertz things?
Ah, okay. Yeah, I don't have. Well, this is okay. The zero. Well, you have to extrapolate. You mean the zero temperature, the pinning threshold? Yeah. Okay, we can. Okay, should be around here. I mean, it's, we don't have a functional form as. We can get it from fitting, but we can. No, but okay. Let me just in the next slide we have a. Okay, let me continue with. Yeah, but this is, it's purely empirical. We don't have a theory for this temperature dependence.
But the exponent beta, which describes the offset of the curve, would be smaller than 1, no? It starts like this, not like this.
Well, you have the thermal rounding regime that makes you. Okay, yeah, no, that's right, yeah. Yeah, at zero temperature, we expect a curvature like this. Yeah, that's right.
The rounding is so huge here, the exponent beta would only be relevant for very small differences, distances from the critical point, so maybe.
Well, yes. So next, what we saw is, okay, you see that this creep regime is valid until some point, some field. So it's valid for small applied fields. But at the moment, there are some deviations. And when we look at these deviations, what we found is that they can be fairly well described by a linear dependence. So what I'm saying is that the barriers, instead of having a power law or divergence at zero field, they have a linear dependence of the fields, which is well described by this formula like this. So, this is the barrier. So this is somehow expected that when we approach the pinning field, the barrier should vanish because we don't have any more. But what is surprising here is that there are many ways to barriers to vanish, and what we find, which is consistent with these fits, is that we find a linear vanishing of the barriers as we approach the pinning field. And this is also a way, if we extrapolate this, to get this again this dependent field as a function of temperature. And this is the way we have done it. So it's a self-consistent way to get this dependent field as a function of temperature. Okay, this is what we call the TAF regime. Okay, because it's very similar to what was proposed in the beginning for the creep regime. So it's a crossover from one creep regime to another creep regime. So, yeah.
If I look at your volume curve.
Sorry?
Why should I not think of the longer stretch in the green curve on the right as being the linear thing, and then there's something that is non linear approach to change?
Here?
No, on the right. Green?
Yeah. Ah, you mean you can make a fit here with a linear too, do you mean?
Yeah,
well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's okay, here for this fit, you can have an error bar, but this works better than the linear.
So I'm slightly confused. There is one scalar which is each over each fitting to the order, and then I have this variable. So these are different. So V deepening already has the scalars that each
over. Sorry,
in the previous thing.
Yeah.
Previous transference.
And the previous, yeah, sorry.
V is V naught, and then I have the H deepening over H to the quarters scaling up there.
Yeah.
How do I relate that to the variable? How do I relate this expression to the next expression? The expression in your next.
Okay. Okay, you can. I mean, you just propose a thermally activated motion over some barrier that depends on H. And then you can say there is a crossover to a different regime where you cannot anymore describe the creep log with this dependence. And then you just match.
Okay.
It's a matching between the two.
Okay.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, it's very, sorry?
Subtract one from the six components.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, this is a way to describe it. And, no, that he's right there. If you subtract, in fact, this is what we find by fitting this V0. If you subtract one, then you get effectively the same crossover, I mean, a linear dependence, when you approach HDP.
Couldn't you do the same by assuming that there's a threshold to value of V?
Threshold?
Okay, if you take a log of this, what you're looking at is something that looks like aging. So, where V would be your time or something like that. But if you had some minimum value of V, wouldn't that also give you a crossover like this? I mean, you're assuming now that V is can go down to zero. Like, or V can be anything, but shouldn't there be a cutoff value of the velocity?
Well, in principle, if the temperature is very, very small, there should be something like characteristic microscopic velocity, which is related with some attempt frequency of the thermally activated motion. But this case is much more difficult because temperature is not that low, so we just took it as some fitting parameter. But and then show that it's consistent with show the consistence of this prefactor with I'll show you later that this prefactor here will be consistent with the next regime. So we're matching different regimes, and then we find that it's consistent with the picture for the debine. So this is what we find is quite empirical. So what we find is that the creep law is well verified. Then we find something, a crossover to some other regime that we can describe it by barriers that vanish linearly at the dependent transition. And then we have these other predictions, which are for the Lessing lang, which are valid here. For instance, at the critical point, we expect to have a velocity that is described with some exponent, t to the psi. Okay. So what we did is is try to fit this exponent and see if this is consistent with theory. Okay, before going to that, I will just to say a few things about this linear dependence. This is not trivial. Indeed, one can compute this vanishing of barriers for instance, an elastic line in a periodic potential, just to illustrate. In that case, for instance, the barrier vanish as is written here. So you see that only for d equal 2, there is a linear dependence. For d equal 1 is 5/4, which is close, but OK, it's not what we observe. And the only prediction, well, I know from a d-independent linear dependence, very close to the dependent threshold, is a paper by Marcus. And this is consistent with what we found with Alberto during simulations and computing the barrier as a function of the force when we approach the dependent threshold. But of course, this is an open question, and I think more work must be done. So now the idea was to, okay, let's say we fit this formula, and then what we expect from theory is that the velocity should grow as t to the psi at this point. So what we propose is just to do a simple matching between this formula and the formula we expect exactly at the dependent transition. So this is basically saying that we can empirically write this. So you can see that when you approach H depending, then the velocity goes like t to the 5. And by proposing that, we can do a fit as a function of temperature. And what we find is that the psi is around 0.15, some error bars. And now we can compare this with, for instance, with the result of simulations for the elastic line model. And this is work we have done with Sebastian Mussingori and Thierry Jamarchi, where we find a very close value for this exponent. So this is what makes us believe that, okay, taking into account this intrinsic temperature dependencies, and by doing this procedure, we get consistent results with creep, some intermediate regime of creep, which is described with a linear vanishing of barrier, but also at the dependent transition, we find a result that is consistent with the elastic spring theory.
So there's no analytical result for psi yet.
There's no
analytical result for psi.
No, for this exponent, there's no.
There are conjectures.
Yeah, that's right. Perfect. Yeah. Well, there's one conjecture that actually quantified. But there are many conjectures. I shouldn't put one in particular, but one that we were discussing with Marcus is something like this. I mean, this is telling us that this exponent is indeed not an independent one, but could be related with other exponents. But okay, there are also some other proposals that this is really a new exponent. It's an old paper. So, but this must be checked. I mean, this is one of the things I would like to motivate for theoreticians. But in summary, what I wanted to tell you is that these systems can be described, or at least the results are consistent with this simple one-dimensional quencher or Wilkinson equation. But it's not easy to expose this universality. We have to disentangle this extrinsic and intrinsic temperature dependence. And of course, an open question is this linear vanishing of the barriers and the possible connection with the thermal rounding of the dependent transition that is described by this exponent. So now I would like just to go look closer at the universal creep motion, because actually this formula was obtained by using very strong assumptions that I'll discuss now. And let me just review which is the, well, I don't want to enter into much detail, but the assumptions they did to find this formula are the following. They assume that the interface during its slow motion is basically at equilibrium, so they have they use a static description of the interface. Other assumption they did is that the energy varies scale as energy minima, because we don't have any access to energy barriers for a given length scale. What they use is the scaling for the energy minima as a function of the length scale. And then they also assume the existence of typical barriers that we could use to compute the velocity. So basically, the argument starts from the from the energy of the system, the elastic energy, the disorder potential, and the applied force. And basically, the calculation is a nucleation. What we calculate is the size of a critical nucleus. So we have we compute the barrier to produce this excitation, taking into account that this changes the energy depending on the size of the excitation, but also that we gain energy by going in the direction of the force. After doing this calculation and using the static description of the interface, what we get is exactly that the thermal nucleus, the optimal nucleus or critical nucleus, is described by this 1 over f to this exponent that I already showed you. Now, using this value, you can plug it again into the energy, and then you can get an estimate of the optimal value you have to overcome in order to move. And using this, you get the creep formula. Okay, so this is what we can discuss later even. So the first assumption that the energy varies should scale as energy minima was proven here in this paper a long time ago. So this is an assumption that seems to be okay. However, the static description of the interface turned out to be not completely valid, and this is particularly was shown in the paper by Pierre Pascal Chauve and Thierry Jamarchi. What they have shown using a functional normalization group is that for the creep motion is that below, but this is below the thermal nucleus, the interface can be described as in equilibrium, but if you see at larger length scale, actually the motion is dependent like. So this is very different from just assuming a static description of the interface. And this is showing us that the creep motion is far from equilibrium motion. It's not, so in other words, if you take a picture of a domain wall that is moving very slowly, if the picture is large enough, you can tell just by looking at the geometry of the line that this is not an equilibrium elastic line or equilibrium interface. And this was confirmed by numerics with Alberto. We confirmed this picture that the interface at short length scales can be described by static roughness exponents, but at large length scales it is described by the pinning roughness exponents. So this is what I mean when I say that looking at the geometry, you can realize that you are far from equilibrium, even if the velocity is vanishing, is very small. Another result we got is that usually the dependent transition is seen, which happens here, is seen as a standard phase transition where you have a diversion length scale. But for the dynamic below threshold, we find that there's no diversionless scale on the other side. So this is not like the IC model where we can, in the steady state, find two diversionless scales, which are both above and below FC. So let's say that.
So can you record how you define this LVX?
So basically, the idea that during the creep motion you have to trigger some thermal nucleus by thermal activations. Then after this, you usually have some deterministic relaxation, right? So this is size of the thermal nucleus, and this can produce a deterministic motion without barriers up to some length, which we call a relax. Okay? This is the meaning of the.
So that does diverge again, FFC, right? Coming from
Yeah, that's right. But when you look at the steady state correlation of the last line, that okay, I can show you how can we get steady state properties, but it's a transient property. So let's say that this means that if you activate a very small barrier here, you will produce a big avalanche, in fact, like the ones you have here. But this is only a part of the process, and in fact, this happens in a time scale which is negligible with the time scale of the creep motion, and this somehow you don't see this transient effect.
So
in the geometry.
Short time scale effect,
yeah.
The picture of the main wall, the roughness is the one of the decreasing and large scale, and not the one of the static.
Of the equivalent, the static.
Yeah. So, it's like, you take a,
But where would you get that L optimum from looking at?
I explain that because it's not that that simple. In fact, yeah.
There is a question.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
But if you look at some finite temperature and you average this correlation made by the instantaneous velocity, can you recount something?
No. At finite temperature, at finite temperature, this is obtained at very small temperature, not this area.
So
at finite temperature, this would diverge not here, but would diverge at, let's say, here. So this line will continue like this. I'll show you a picture in the next slide. But you never see a signature of a divergent correlation
length. Because you're not doing what I'm suggesting. I'm saying you should look at manifold when it's moving, not at the long times when it's
stopped. This is not
below,
a steady state correlation length, right?
Below a given very large landscape, we expect to observe the roughness at equilibrium? No. This was a dot. So you do not have closed critical point, the equilibrium roughness. I think that you don't see this length scale because you're averaging blindly over time, so you just see the thing stuck, you know. But if you want to see the diverging length scale, you have to focus on the times when it's moving, so you have to.
Yes, we see and relax is divergent.
And this is diverging with the same exponent than here, and it's, everything is.
This is the scale, there is no diverging next scale below critical force, which is not clear.
I think we just say there are two next scales, which is sort of interesting, right? One is not diverging at all, and one is diverging.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing in the IC model, you can get in equilibrium or in the steady state, you can get clearly two diverging length scales when on.
You don't see this
if we do the same for the steady state of the atomic wall, we don't find a diversion scale on this side. So just by looking at the steady state properties, we don't find it. But of course, we can find it. This deterministic size appearing, not this deterministic relaxation. Yeah, we can.
You can tell us what L optimum is, right?
Well, this is the size of the thermal nucleus, and what I'm showing here is that actually this is.
Can you switch on?
Okay. Well, I can. I can. No, but I have
you can just write on that side. Yes.
So there is a. This is the size of the thermal nucleus that is controlling the velocity of the interface. So what this diagram is saying is basically that if you look at the interface at these scales below this elopt, then the interface looks like in equilibrium with the Rafflin exponent that is exactly the same as in equilibrium. But as soon as you start to see the interface at longer length scales, and you measure the roughness of this interface, you start to see a roughness which is very different from this one and is equal to the roughness at the dependent transition. Okay? Okay, then one can ask what happens at larger length scale, but this larger length scale at very small temperature is very, very large. It's very, very large. But actually, there's another crossover that we can discuss later. Is it clear? So this is mainly describing the geometry of the line for different forces. So this is just to say that, just to question this assumption that was done for deriving the Crib law. So we see that this assumption is not completely valid, although we get the correct result. But the one I would like to discuss now and to finish the talk is this one, which is the typical independent champ assumption. Because in this argument, in the nucleation picture argument, we just assume that we have some thermal nucleus, we champ some barrier, which has some dependent with the force, and then we just repeat the process as imagining we have another avalanche here, and et cetera. So is this true? And also, there's another question. We are assuming that everything is dominated by some typical nucleus, which has some size. But what about the distribution of this? Are there small activated champ like this? Are big ones? How are they distributed? Are they correlated between? So this is work in progress, and I think we have nice results. This is work we're doing with Ezequiel Ferrero, Laura Foine Thierry, and Alberto Rosso. And okay, in order to understand this, in order to answer that question, it's impossible just to solve this equation. And this is just an example. If you simulate this equation with thermal noise, okay, you can get some creepy-like motion, but then you cannot study the problem at very slow temperature due to the futile motion effect. In fact, when you reduce the temperature, the line is blocked most of the time, and you only have this kind of futile motion. So this is not possible to do just with brute force simulation of the model. So that's why we have used another method, which is method in a lattice, but it's basically the same energy. So we work now in the lattice. We describe some elastic line in some disordered media. We assume an harmonic elasticity, which is described by this elastic term. We have the force, and then we have the disordered potential. And what we do here, instead of solving by Monte Carlo, is to find the exact transition pathways that allow the interface go forward. Okay. This is very related to the Cindy's talk about pathways. And it's not trivial, as we saw, it's not trivial at all how to do it for an extended system because it has so many degrees of freedom, so many paths. But what we know is that at very small temperatures, the interface should follow an optimal path, right? And that optimal path can be found by looking among all the possible paths as the one that takes you to the next metacellular state with lower energy, but overcoming the smallest barrier. So this seems to be very difficult to do, but actually for our system, we can prove some theorems that tell us that that we can do it. And not only that, but we can show that the dynamics is attracted to a sequence of metastable state that we can construct like this. Imagine you start from some metastable state alpha, then we can generate all the possible moves, elementary moves from to go forward, and then among all of them we can get the one that allows us to go to the next metastable state with lower energy. So this is a procedure that can be repeated once we are here, we can repeat these procedures. So in some sense, we are finding an optimal path. And this optimal path is visiting some metastable state, which we can show. These are the metastable state that dominate the steady state dynamics. So let me. Sorry? Yeah, right. This is in the limit of the, let's call it the Arrhenius limit, when the temperature goes to zero. Okay, the line will perform the optimal path. Okay.
So the dynamics become deterministic.
They becoming in some sense become deterministic, right? Yeah.
So then the interesting question is about what these paths look like, right?
Yeah. And also if these paths are unique, right? Because, okay, we can construct them, but then are they unique? And
how stable are they?
Sorry?
How stable are they?
If they are
have some thermal step that takes you away from the path, will it take you far away from the path, or will it converge?
Because this system has very special properties, which are related with the Middleton non-passing rules. In fact, this is, we can prove some theorems for the activated dynamics that tells you that this is, in fact, there is an attractor for the.
Yeah. You need the non-passing rules.
Yeah.
Theory makes perfect path, but you'll never get.
Yeah, well, this is very, very, very special for this system, and so we can then construct. Okay, the this is the optimal pathway for a small system, and. Okay, and what you can see is, okay, you can start with any initial condition, then you start this procedure, and you see that after a while, you really get trapped into a unique sequence of metastable state. No matter how you start, at long times, we get the same sequence of metastable state, and this metastable state will determine the properties of the steady state, because these metastable states are the ones that have the largest barrier. So at t, when t goes to zero, this will dominate. So this is probably more clearly seen for one particle in the disorder potential. You can actually there compute many things, and you can see that when you go, the temperature goes to zero. So in this problem, I have some pictures, right? So for a particle in the disorder potential like this, which is tilted. Okay, you can show that there are some special metastable state that will dominate. So you will find with a much larger probability the particle here than here. And this metastable state will dominate the steady state dynamics. So any property in the steady state can be computed just by computing average over this metastable state.
It's the one which has the largest barrier.
Yeah, exactly.
How does this algorithm scale the system size?
Well, very, very badly. That's because it's And in fact, the problem is not the system size, but it's the size of the thermal nucleus. Because, I mean, what we do is we start to do all the possible elementary moves on the elastic line. And by moving. By doing all the possible moves of different sizes. And when we find one path that takes you to a state which has lower energy, then we just go to that state, and then the process stops and we restart again. So this is mainly controlled because this process is mainly controlled by the size of this jump, right? Because, I mean, once you find this nucleus, you don't need to consider motions over a larger length scale.
And the reason it scales the system size poorly is because you have that many of them.
And you see that it's a problem because when H goes to zero, when the force goes to zero, this diverges. So we cannot go to very small forces with this algorithm. But we can make some approximations that allow us indeed to reach that regime. But in principle, this way of constructing the optimal path is exact.
Okay.
this set for this discrete problem. And okay, it's like, no, well, it's
can you compute the roughness of this path?
Yeah, yeah, we can.
What are
the roughness of the path, sorry?
Yeah, the roughness of the surfaces.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. This is how we got the diagram.
Just it's showing. The
yeah, yeah.
So
what,
same.
What we found, we analyzed the geometry of the line at different forces, and we find these different exponents. Okay, this two. So as you see, we cannot enter very deeply in the crib regime due to this limitation. In fact, it grows exponentially with the size of the thermal nucleus. So you see,
so
we cannot.
There.
Sorry.
It's the bottom line.
Yes, it's the bottom line.
So, okay, this is a method we can, we'd like to discuss it with you if you wish. So this, the sequence of the metastable state we find is indeed unique. We can prove it. So this is the steady state attractor of the T going to zero, but not zero, of the dynamics, right? So this is, okay, just showing some sequence. And what we can do with this, because this is, actually, the dynamics of grip at very small temperatures is that we can compute now the distribution of thermal. Okay, this in the other direction, but we can now compute. These are all the jumps we obtain at different. Okay, by increasing the time, and as you can see, there is a very broad distribution of sizes. So the image of a typical characteristic thermal nucleus, well, it's not. It's not that clear, but anyway, we can ask what is this characteristic size we have computed before in this distribution of sizes. So from each one of these, we can get, for instance, the area or the transverse size. We can also get the barrier if you are using the exact algorithm. So we can compute the distribution of these thermal jumps.
So where is the thermal nucleus and where is the relaxed
avalanche?
So yeah, yeah. These are the two when the force is very, very small, as we are doing using here, actually a relax. The deterministic avalanche is very small, so this is mainly
same thing.
They are very similar. So but what I'm showing here is that both together. So I activate a jump, I let it relax, and then you get the new configuration. But they look almost the same for very small forces. This is not true when you are close to the pinion. You trigger something small, and you can trigger a very big deterministic avalanche.
Two or three sides.
Yeah.
You have to add two or three sides.
Yeah, yeah, it's not, okay. Yeah. They are mostly the same. So. So okay, these are let's say.
It's well, about statistics between minima and saddles, right?
Yeah. So this is we can now compute the distribution. Okay, these are not avalanches as in the dependent transition, but they are irreversible jumps. And what we find is this power law distribution of sizes. Okay. And what I'm showing here is that. Okay, they can be described by this power law with some cutoff that depends on the force. Okay, and the cutoff we find that it has this dependence, so it diverges with the force. Okay, so this is very similar to the distribution of avalanches in the pinion. At the dependent transition, right?
It's not an avalanche.
It's not an avalanche, yeah. It's an irreversible jump, activated jump.
You keep saying irreversible. Could you clarify why you're using?
No, in the sense that at very small temperatures, when you produce a jump, the probability to come back is So in that sense, I see it. I see them like.
Okay. So it's strictly irreversible only at zero
time. Yeah.
So the two exponents is the same as the dependent transition? Is it the same exponent
and two? Well, this is a working process, but it's very close.
It's very close.
So very close. But these are not avalanches.
1.15.
Yeah.
But you and can distinguish between, so it's not the equilibrium part.
Yeah.
But did you compare with the avalanche you get at the penetration? Would you have the same map of avalanches?
No, yeah, you see the cutoff is different.
The cutoff is, well.
Yeah, but if you get rid of the cutoff, just let's look at the shape.
Okay,
it will show that.
So
yeah,
you
yeah.
can exclude the tau is expand for the shock from.
We have not understood that.
Yeah, this is, I mean, just. The results. I mean, this is
sample.
This is really open. We have it's an open question how to understand this power law distribution. But what is very nice to see here is that the cutoff of the distribution is very related with the size of the thermal nucleus. So.
And the reason you say these are not the avalanches is I could actually trigger a electric event.
But this also sort of looks like what Mark Robbins showed on Monday, right? That he has these sort of very small events in his system that aren't correlated with stress drops in the system. And yet they sort of have a very similar power law to what he calls avalanches. So I just think, just as a comment, I think interesting, because I don't understand, frankly, I don't understand his very small events. It may be, I mean, I have no idea.
Well, let me. Let me show you something else.
I agree, but I'm just saying, you know.
Okay. Yeah, no, you would. No, but this is very, very related with the correlation. Yeah. Okay, should I? Okay, we have a power law distribution, we have a cutoff, and actually this cutoff satisfies very well this relation. So there is a cutoff that depends on the force we are applying, and it's divergent when the force goes to zero. Actually, this cutoff can be directly related with the size of the thermal nucleus, the typical size of the thermal nucleus that is used, okay, that is derived in the derivation of the creep law. So actually, the critical nucleus that is compute for computing the creep law is actually the cutoff of a broad distribution of activated events. And you can see both the area and the lateral size of these events satisfy a power law, which is the same one that is expected for the thermal nucleus. So what I'm saying, somehow it is expected, is that although in the derivation of the creep law, this distribution is not taken into account, actually, because this is the cutoff of the distribution, it is expected that the velocity would be dominated by the largest events, right? So this is compatible with that fact that the velocity should be controlled by the largest thermal nucleus because they have the largest barrier to overcome. So this is entirely consistent with the creep law, but it's also showing that the typical value of the thermal nucleus is just the cutoff of a broad distribution of activated events. So it is nice now.
Your L optimum is just that cutoff.
Yeah, it's cutoff. But now we can ask if this is similar to the. Okay, these are not avalanches, but we because the exponents are well, similar, and then we can ask whether this. All these activated events are similar to the avalanches we see in the same model, but triggered by a spring. So what we do here is just to compare the creep charms I'll show you with the avalanches that are produced in this model. So this model is basically the same one, exactly the same, except that instead of having the drive, which is the driving force here, we have a parabola that is driving the quasi-statically the interface. So we know that this will produce avalanches because this tunes the system at the critical point. So basically what we will produce by moving the parabola is a sequence of avalanches that we know that is described by a power law. And the cutoff is controlled by this mass. And we can also study the same model but in statics, which are called the static shocks, which is basically the same protocol, except that instead of visiting different metastable states as we move the parabola, we can find which is the global minima as we move the parabola, and these are called static shocks. So now, I'm not going to enter into much detail, but because maybe you are very familiar with these two situations, I would like to show you the differences between this kind of jumps and these jumps I'm describing. So we know that both have a power law distribution, but actually there is a more important difference, which is in this plot. What I'm plotting here is, okay, as we do the different protocols, we have avalanches, and we can plot the avalanches, okay, as this line here. So this is the lateral extension of an avalanche. This is the event number zero. Okay, there was an avalanche of this size at this location. And then we can continue for each one of the avalanches we had. Okay, so okay, for this situation, the parameters are such that we have very small but also very big avalanches. But as you can see, okay, we have avalanches everywhere here. These are called the static shocks or static jumps. Each metastable state is a global minima of the system or as we move the parabola as we move the spring. This is the same but for the pinning avalanches. Okay, as you can see, we have avalanches of all sizes as we expect. And as we move the parabola, we visit many regions of the space. We know that these two are described by very well-defined power laws where we can compute the exponents and etc.
For the random field, they are the same.
There is a conjecture, but we think we have proved that it's wrong. Yeah, we get the same. We get the same scaling function, scaling.
The tuning.
No, not random field nucleation model. I'm saying random field model, not his model. Random field nucleation where you allow things to flip anywhere. They're the same in both. But here, and I know that for the pinning, they're not. That's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
no, I thought that what you want to say is that the statics at random field disorder is the same to the pinning.
Okay, maybe the hand will finish because we are on.
We can discuss here that. But okay, you can see that there's very big difference from these two plots and this plot. These are actually the creep jumps I've shown you. You can see that there is a very strong correlation that we are now trying to characterize. Indeed, it looks like there's some event that is triggering some events that are nearby and they spread like probably an unzipping motion. And they spread over the whole system, seemingly. This is so this is very, very important difference. If there is some correlation here that, I mean, it's for sure much weaker in these two situations than in here, okay? So in this sense, even if we get an exponent which is very close to the one for the distribution, that is very, very similar to this one, and for the pinning avalanches, we see that correlation between activated events are much stronger than for the pinning avalanches or static jumps. And I would like to show you a movie how is that this moves. So these are the creep jumps. This is the same picture. So this is a space-time diagram. And what I'm showing here is the interface that is moving, okay, from the center of mass, and is producing these thermal jumps, okay, of different sizes. But as you can see, there's a very strong correlation between events that goes like move in a space like this. Okay. Okay. One could say, okay, maybe these are after main shocks and aftershocks. We are not sure. But what is sure is that we have strong correlation here that are very different from from the bin in avalanche that I can show you later. So this is what we find. Okay. So this is about more or less. Is it clear this movie? So I can show you also what happens just for comparison with the static shocks. You see that the correlations are much weaker. Static shocks can appear. Okay, they correlate much faster, and this is already seen here, right? We're looking at these windows of events, and you see that they were very spread. So the correlations are very different for these jams, and these are the pinning avalanches, and also look very much the same than the static one, and very different from the creep jams I have just shown you. So this is work in progress. There are many open issues and many open questions. One question is, by looking at this picture, the question is, okay, there are very large correlations. Do these correlations diverge in the sense that they will spread in the whole system? Well, this is an open question we're analyzing now. That might be probably related with the fact that we are in this region of the phase diagram, and maybe we could have critical fluctuations here. This is an open question. So with this, I just would like to go to the conclusion. So in the first part, I show you that these systems, these ferromagnetic fields, seems to be well described by a very simple universality class, which is the most simple we can think about for a one-dimensional domain wall in random media, which is the Quench Edward Wilkinson universality class. It was both the results at creep, also dynamics below just below threshold, and thermal rounding at the dependent transition is consistent with this. So this makes us believe that maybe this is a good model to describe. We have also seen that the creep law and the assumption of the typical thermal nucleus is correct, but this typical thermal nucleus is not just a mean value is actually the cutoff of the power law distribution of a thermal activity jumps. Most importantly, probably, is that we see a lot of correlation between these activated jumps that I think were never seen experimentally. So that would be nice to motivate for experiments. Okay, thank you for the